My name is Laura Bowling, and I'm an engineer. Let's just get that out of the way right now. In fact, I dug through my bookshelf, and I am pretty sure that this is the textbook for the only course on soils that I had as an undergraduate. You might be interested in looking at the table of contents for the soil composition chapter, where it discusses things like the liquidity index and the plasticity chart, not bacteria or organic matter or fungi. So it was a course in soil mechanics. Despite that, I'm going to stand up here and tell you that you should listen to my opinions about how soils function across the landscape. And I'm going to do that because I'm trained as a hydrologist, and so that's my point of reference. And I would say that the fundamental variable that hydrologists use, the most consistently measured hydrologic variable, is stream flow, or discharge, as I've labeled it here. And discharge represents an integration of all of the processes that are going on within a watershed. So if my students in my lab class are standing here on a bridge measuring discharge on the Wabash River, then they can look at that time series and infer a great deal of information about the soil function in all of that land area that's draining to that point in the Wabash River. This is a classic example that I used to like to use in class to illustrate that point of what we can infer when we look at the time series of hydrologic response as measured by discharge. So I like it, one, because it was measured in 1947, and it's good for students to realize that things were happening before they were alive, but also because it's two tributaries that are very close to the West Lafayette campus, Wildcat Creek and Tippecanoe River, that come into the Wabash River. And so this is 1 year in time, and they have very different characteristics. You can see that Wildcat Creek has a peak stream flow that exceeds 1,500 cubic feet per second, whereas the Tippecanoe River is only about 200 cubic feet per second. I'll point out that this is not really about spatial scale. They're both similar-sized watersheds, 166 square miles versus 126 square miles. And so, as the title suggests, what they discussed in this paper, that this was due to fundamental differences in the soils across these watersheds. More impermeable glacial drift, as they called it, in the Wildcat Creek watershed, whereas in Tippecanoe River watershed, there were much deeper soils, permeable glacial deposits that would allow a lot more water to move into the soil, more storage capacity for that water to be released more slowly over time. And we can see the influence of those soils when we examine the stream hydrograph. It's this difference in information, it's this type of soils information that we really need to quantify and capture if then I want to bring in my modeling tools to try to simulate the difference between these two watersheds. I need to be able to capture these types of characteristics. So one other caveat before I start talking about model inputs is that I am simulating response in Indiana. It tends to be pretty flat, a depressional landscape, and so we have a lot of subsurface tile drains that the producers use in order to make the land productive. And so that adds another level of variability in our hydrologic modeling. So I do use modeling tools quite a bit in my research, and in the 10 years that I've been at Purdue, I've tried to use a variety of models to look at drained landscapes. Starting with DrainMod, a classic field scale drainage model, DHSVM, a fully distributed watershed scale model, SWAT, quite commonly used in watershed applications in agricultural areas, semi-distributed model, and then getting up to the scale that we just heard about from the previous speaker, looking at the land surface scheme, continental scale type modeling. So I want to start with talking about what are some of the common characteristics we need as input to these models, regardless of the type of model we're using and regardless of the spatial scale. So first and foremost, I'd say one of our most important things is a measure of the effect of moisture storage. And I'm going to try to avoid using actual titles of the quantities I want, because I don't really care what you call them. What I care is about how they function. So I need to know how much water can be stored in the soil. Any hydrology model that's worthy of the name is going to start with some sort of expression of the land surface water balance, where the change in storage within the soil column, that DSDT, is balanced by inflows and outflows. So precipitation being our primary inflow, and then we have outflows in terms of evapotranspiration, overland flow, subsurface flow, and maybe some percolation out the bottom. So what I'm calling my effective storage capacity, how much water can I store in that soil column? The total depth times the difference between the maximum water content that we can hold in that soil pore space and then minus the minimum extractable water content. need to point out that this percolation term that may exist at the bottom is extremely difficult to define. We're never really going to know what it is very well. And so it's very important to define the bottom of our control volume above some limiting layer or some hydrologically not active layer so that we can better make assumptions about what that percolation is at the bottom. So this is often a problem in terms of if we don't have measurements that go deep enough to the point where we can make those sorts of estimations. So because soil depth is a quantity that's sort of easy to get our minds around, I have a few examples that describe how we've used soil depth, this estimate of effective moisture storage, in hydrologic modeling context, and what is some of the limitations of the current data that we have are. First, I'm going way back in time, just like Philip Owens did at the beginning. I'm going back to my master's research. And so these are illustrations from two small watersheds in western Washington. What you can't tell from these images is that these are quite steep, 5 square kilometer watersheds, and I think the total elevation change is about 2,000 meters. The upper left panel is showing the soil information, the soil types that come from Stathco. So this was circa 1996. Sergo data was not available. So two primary soil types, and that break is really following elevation. So based on those, it don't give us much information from those polygons about how soil depth might vary across the watershed. We know from the numerous road cuts in this watershed and the steep terrain that soil depth varies quite a bit more than these two Stathco polygons can show us. So what we did was, using observations from the road cuts, we did a crude first cut to come up with how soil depth varied across this landscape, buffering streams, buffering ridge tops to have shallower soils on the ridge tops, deeper soils in the valley bottoms. And then we used this in a hydrologic model to look at the difference. Now, hydrology models are notorious for not doing very well in reproducing summer low flows. And when we're talking about surface water hydrology models, they don't typically have enough storage capacity to really sustain flow throughout the summer. And this is what we were looking at with this comparison. In the left figure, I'm showing the model simulations when I had a variable soil depth layer. And in the right one, I'm showing simulations with a constant soil depth across the watershed of 0.9 meters, not an atypical assumption in hydrologic modeling. So this is showing the saturated thickness during a period of a big rainfall event in April 1996. And what I really want you to notice is that yellow and orange color in the valley bottom on the left, that when we have deeper soils, we can, of course, have more soil moisture storage. What's interesting is as you go forward in time, 3 days after the rain event, another 3 days after the rain event, that soil moisture storage is persistent. And so we've now increased the capacity that we have persistence in the model that is going to allow water to drain out and become base flow in between rain events because we have a more realistic representation of soil depth, even at that crude level. As we go up quite a bit in scale, we have similar problems. So now going up to continental scale applications where we use land surface schemes to simulate hydrology and water resources across the whole country, and we tend to have similar problems. Over-prediction of flow during the high flow periods, under-prediction in the summer. What I'm showing here is the depth to bedrock field that is in the Penn State CONUS data set. So this is probably 2 decades old at this point, the data set that was based on Stathco data. And so I had instructed a grad student working with me to pull out this depth layer because we were having trouble with our continental scale model simulations. Well, you can see that we might still have a problem with our continental scale model simulations. If you look at this sort of wide area of soils in the middle of the country that all have a depth of 152 centimeters. So if there are not observations deeper than 152 centimeters, then that is the value that's in the database, right? So we still don't really know how soil depth varies across the middle of the country. Because of that, one of the typical things that happen is that soil depth actually becomes a calibration parameter in our large-scale modeling. And so the map in this figure is showing the calibrated soil depth for the land data assimilation system modeling. This was the first generation done several years ago. And you should notice that there's some very odd patterns if you start calibrating on soil depth. Now you have soil depth values that follow watershed boundaries than any kind of physical properties or landscape variation. And so in particular in the upper Mississippi River, you can see that watershed sort of standing out that's bright green with a different soil depth than the surrounding watersheds. This becomes especially a problem if you want to transfer parameters to watersheds that have not been directly calibrated, which is typically an approach. You calibrate some of the watersheds, and then you need to move beyond those watershed boundaries. Now we don't know what value to use because we've calibrated values that we should be able to observe directly or tie to things that could be observed. Okay, so jumping to another aspect of soil parameters that we need in hydrologic modeling is some quantification of rates of inflow and outflow into the soil column. So this is getting at vertical inflow, so infiltration at the soil surface, and I just want to point out that if we're talking about water flow perpendicular to a layered medium, we are limited by the lowest conductivity layer, as opposed to when you're talking about water flow that's parallel to a layered media, the water is going to preferentially flow along the highest conductivity layer. So vertical conductivity and lateral conductivity are inherently different concepts, and they tend to be orders of magnitude different in scale. The lateral conductivity is, in general, across any hydrologic model that I've ever used, one of the most influential parameters, and one that is almost always obtained through calibration. And you can pretty much improve your model fit no matter what model you're using if you adjust the parameter that has to do with the lateral rate of water movement. Vertical becomes important when you're looking at the rate of inflow at the soil surface, partitioning precipitation between infiltration and overland flow. But other than that, in my past applications, it's never really been that important for my work. But I am finding that when I look at tile drainage applications, that vertical rate of water movement has become a more sensitive quantity. And I have an example to illustrate why that might be. Here I'm showing results from the long-term drainage experiment at the Southeast Purdue Ag Center. And in this case, the blue line represents simulated drain flow. Both the red line and the green dots represent observations. They're the same observations, but the green dots are meant to highlight places where drain flow was observed when the water table was below the depth of the drain. And so in most models that are trying to predict to simulate drain flow, they start with a basic assumption that drainage starts when the water table rises above the height of the drain. And what we seem to be seeing in these observations is that it's not necessarily true. And so perhaps preferential flow path, an effective vertical conductivity that is different than matrix flow alone, might be more of a driving force in these types of applications. Okay, well, you're going to have to stand for a minute because I haven't gotten to what Zamir wanted me to talk about.
Okay. I'll give you a little bit more because you're the last speaker.
All right, you guys have to wait for me for break because this is what Zamir told me to talk about. Okay, so that was sort of things that are common across hydrologic models, but now as we think about the scale of our application and how our models might differ, we need to talk a little bit about the spatial variability. And so I have to start with a reference to a very influential paper of my life by Siffried and Wilcox in 1992. And they were hypothesizing, or stating more than hypothesizing, that a deterministic length scale exists in hydrologic response. What that means is that depending on the extent or your scale of observation, lost my train of thought. I was trying to be fast. If you are much large, you can define the process that is controlling variability at that scale. And if you're looking at a spatial scale that's larger than that, you might not need to explicitly define the source of variability. The variability might still be important, but it might be better represented as a stochastic process as opposed to an explicit definition of the source of variability. Let me try to say that in words that make more sense. So they went through five different examples within the Reynolds Creek watershed, starting at sort of a small hill slope or plot scale. If you're looking at runoff response at that scale, they found that infiltration into the soil was very different. It was double if you were under a shrub versus if you were in between two shrubs. So if you needed to understand runoff response at that scale, you needed to know where every shrub was on the hill slope. But then they went up in scale at a small watershed, and they found that soil depth became very important in defining groundwater recharge and runoff response. And if you were looking at that scale, you didn't need to know where the shrubs were anymore, because the soil depth was the controlling process at that deterministic length scale. And so you might still need to represent variability because of the shrubs, but perhaps it's better represented by a probability distribution instead of by explicit definition. So I'm going to cut it off, and I'll just show one example, and then I'll skip to my summary. So in an application using the DrainMod model, we were looking at the Hoagland watershed in White County, Indiana. So this has a scale of interest on the order of 15 to 30 kilometers. There were 72 soil series mapped across this watershed, but at our scale of interest, those soil series were not describing the variability that was controlling hydrologic response in this drained watershed. What we determined was that the parent material that had a deterministic length scale that was larger, of 10 to 15 kilometers, was really the variability that was of interest. And so instead of using soil series values directly, we used the soil parent material and tied our soil properties to that parent material and used that as input to the hydrologic model. And so that would be an example of where we're taking into account the scale of interest as well as the dominant spatial variability. We can define similar scales for other models and other resolutions, but I'm going to skip to my summary. So soil properties, sorry to be the one to tell you this, but they're typically calibrated in hydrologic models, not because we don't know that soil is important, but because we figure those are our greatest sources of uncertainty. And so we feel that we're often better off by calibrating those values than using values that we don't believe. This practice has a lot of limitations. It limits our ability to transfer parameters to ungauged watersheds in particular. There are fundamental needs for any hydrologic model, including quantifying the effective storage in the soil, the limiting rate of inflow, and the maximum rate of outflow out of the soil. And ultimately, the scale of application determines the sources of variability that should be considered in producing the final soil maps. Not all maps need to be created equal. We need different maps for different applications. Thanks a lot.